go-to workout routine. Spinning, yoga, walking across the Brooklyn Bridge. Your favorite leave-in conditioner. Davinus, Orbe, coconut oil. Your latest girl crush. I never have an answer for this. Let's just say coconut oil. And if you're presenting at an award show, which other presenter you're most excited to meet? Be sure to think of someone beforehand. Otherwise, even though you're surrounded by dozens of your idols, you will draw a complete blank. I'm excited to meet that guy from that movie with the people in it. At a minimum, you'll be asked each of these questions approximately 10,000 times in every interview for the rest of your life. In addition to being asked to reveal intimate details about your love life, you'll also constantly be encouraged to dish about your co-stars, to which there's only one acceptable answer, that you're obviously one big happy family, which you, savvy reader, already knew. Then, after you successfully dodge this question, they'll ask you who's the best kisser you've ever worked with. Don't answer this! It will result in an article stating you've broken your silence about how awful it was to kiss everyone else. Finally, you'll be asked about all the pranks everyone supposedly pulls on each other on set all the time. Most films and television shows have very long hours, and no one I know pulls pranks on set, except maybe George Clooney, though I'm pretty sure I read that in a magazine, so who can say for sure? Incidentally, when I was first doing Gilmore Girls, I'd run into George on the lot sometimes, and he was always very nice to me and acted like he knew who I was and treated me like I was behaving normally, which is very kind in the face of my babbling and drooling. However, it wasn't enough to make George say, Amal, Slamal, or anything like that, and the weird dating years and my difficulty in explaining them continued. I was once set up with an actor by my assistant who was friends with the other actor's assistant. The actor wanted to meet me because he saw my sort of real face on a giant billboard on Sunset Boulevard. You know, the way everybody gets asked out. While on location, I had a fun relationship with someone who revealed at the end of the movie that he had a girlfriend back home, just like how your grandparents met. I shook hands with a cute guy for the first time while presenting him with an award. Backstage, we had charming banter. He asked for my phone number, then didn't call me for 3 months. 3 months! Of course, when he finally called, I told him politely that he'd waited too long, and I didn't appreciate being disrespected like that. Nope. I went out with him anyway. I wanted to hold out for men with good behavior, but ultimately I gave in to less good behavior because I was working all the time and wasn't sure when the next chance to meet someone would be. One thing I learned, starting off with very low standards, is a surefire way to ensure they'll be met. Not surprisingly, none of the relationships that started during Billboard Face Award Show presenter time stuck. After all, how many successful, lasting unions do you know that began with the words, "And the winner is"? Plus, if you're meeting someone for the first time after 3 hours of hair, makeup, and styling, you've already set the bar too high. There is no way they won't be disappointed when you reveal your true self. Hey! Where were those boobs I was promised when I saw you up on the podium? Hey, look over there! Isn't that Ryan Seacrest? Also, if you think actors are already self-obsessed, imagine actors who are at a show that exists solely to affirm they are indeed as great as they might think they are. Lots of attention and praise and hot girls everywhere bring out the humble side in everyone. It wasn't just the guys I met who were the problem. In more ways than just being covered in 80 layers of self-tanner, the person they were meeting wasn't really me, either. You know how before a party you clean up your house so that everyone thinks you live that way all the time? That's meeting someone at an award show. It's a way more exaggerated version of meeting anyone you hope to impress for the first time. You present the fresh flowers on the table, bed always made, side of yourself first. But ultimately, you're going to slip and show your house the way it is on a morning when you're running late for work or can't find an outfit. And that's a relationship. Ultimately, everyone who gets close to you is going to see inside your closet on its worst day, and their reaction to that is what will tell you if you're going to make it or not. You can't live an entire life secured in by Spanx. When I started working with Peter on Parenthood, he made a lot of references to the fact that we were playing brother and sister. While true that our characters were siblings, I wasn't sure why it kept coming up. He'd hand me a prop or a cup of coffee and then sort of narrate, handing my sister a cup of coffee. That's my sister drinking the coffee over there. By week two of work, I wanted to say, I get it. I get it. You're not interested in me that way. Well, I don't trust handsome actors either, so we're good. In fact, I think he was actually trying to talk himself out of starting anything. At our age, we'd both probably been through showmances that went south and made work an uncomfortable place to be. But ultimately, our mutual wariness gave way without much discussion or effort. It just sort of happened. That's one thing I've learned when it comes to relationships. There's so much to negotiate once you really get to know someone. The beginning should feel easy and inevitable. By the time Peter and I actually started dating seriously, I finally knew exactly how to handle myself, and all my public versus private issues instantly melted away. Wrong! Instead of making the public part of life easier, it was even more difficult. Now I actually had someone I cared about, which made me care even more about protecting that person and our privacy and our brand new status. So I stuck to my old reliable, I'm dating, without naming any names, until journalists started rolling their eyes to my face. The standoff lasted for a while, but eventually more people found out, and I kept getting asked to talk about it. I continued to say no until I was told an outlet was going to run with it anyway. What to do? I was going on the Today Show around then. Hi, Savannah. And was asked if I wanted to announce us as a couple. Did I? All I knew for sure was that I felt strange. I went on Ellen, where she showed a picture of Peter and me, and I admitted that, yes, I was seeing someone. But in a panic, I referred to him as Fred. She had just shown a picture of me and Peter, which I had okayed. But somehow in the moment, it felt too personal to also say his actual name. Ellen looked at me like I was insane, which thankfully I was used to, since that's pretty much our regular relationship. I was confused. She was confused. Lucy, I need more pamphlets. Not saying anything wasn't really working, but making an announcement of any kind just felt so wrong, too big and weird. Today, in order to grab your already taxed attention, news of any kind sometimes gets positioned as an urgent proclamation or a major confession, some massive secret being revealed, rather than what it really is. Today, an actor you might know from a TV show you may have seen reluctantly admits to something that may or may not be of mild interest to you. A few months into dating, Peter and I planned a vacation to go skiing. In preparation, he took me to REI. I had never been to an REI store and didn't know what REI stood for or what they sold there. I asked him why we had to go. He asked me where I thought people went to get outdoor gear, and I was like, not Barney's? No, Lauren, not Barney's. What I was to discover at REI would blow my mind and weirdly help me understand show business better. First of all, the sign on the front door says free Wi-Fi and inspiration. Whoa. I was impressed by this offer, which was already better than some nice hotels I've stayed in. In fact, if you go to REI right now, you'll probably find me in the glamping section, checking my email and eating freeze-dried watermelon. It didn't take me long to realize that everyone who works at REI is named Tad. Tad has 0% body fat and a deep tan. From the joyous way Tad describes the absorbency levels of the chamois wowzas by the register, you might suspect he is on drugs. But Tad would never take drugs, but with all the fresh air in the world, Tad and all his co-workers, Tad, wear matching vests adorned with loops and hooks. You may briefly wonder if the Tads go out after work wearing their matching vests, or if they're just part of a cult whose members love to fish. Tad is always happy and positive. The only time I've ever seen Tad a little bit down was when I told him I thought all sleeping bags were alike. Don't be sad, Tad. I know better now. Every food available at REI has the word fiber on the package, and everything else they sell has a tough or scary name. The Enforcer, the Prowler, the Trailblazer, the Striker. No, these aren't names of military attack plans. They're just waterproof socks. I was always one of those East Coast kids who refused to button my jacket. I was cold through most of the 1980s. In college, I wore a thin, vintage men's overcoat I got for $12 at Screaming Mimi's. Who thought about warmth? But now I was dating someone who grew up in the Midwest, where cold is no joke, and where being prepared to face the elements is just something a person who isn't an idiot does. Peter knows everything there is to know about outdoorsy things, like what to do if you see a bear. Run? Don't run? I always forget. And if you want to talk about wind resistance ratings or sweat-wicking properties, have I got the guy for you. He's also tried about a million times to explain to me why warm water makes ice cubes faster than cold water, which confounds me to such a degree that I respond by running around the house yelling, I was an English major! I wrote my thesis on Tennyson! But at REI, with the help of Peter and the Tads, I stocked up on thermals and a good ski jacket, plus socks called the Annihilators, the Doomsdays, and the Widowmakers. On our ski trip, I was warm and dry. And I realized, for the first time in my life, that feeling like your toes are going to fall off doesn't have to be part of being outside in the snow. I couldn't believe such comfort existed. I started buying so much outdoor athletic gear that I actually applied for an REI membership card. My bungee cords now earn points. Whether it's on your own or through someone else, it's wonderful to be introduced to something you didn't realize you needed. In learning about the wonders of REI, it occurred to me that going into vulnerable public situations unprepared was a little like facing winter in New York City, or being on the ski slopes with my $12 Screaming Mimi's coat flapping open. I wish I'd learned sooner, but in more ways than one, I now know more about protective layers than I used to. I've learned that a little readiness goes a long way when facing the elements, be they rain or snow or Access Hollywood. Just like in the outdoors, I've learned it's much easier to strip off a layer if you find you don't need it than to put one on. If you've already exposed yourself, it may be too late. Peter has family in Northern California, and the first time I traveled with him there, I stopped short in the middle of the Sonoma County Airport. There, in the center of the lobby, is a life-size Lucy advice booth with a sign that says the doctor is in. Charles Schultz was a native of the area, and Peanuts characters abound. The Lucy booth carries mostly travel pamphlets and maps to wine country rather than advice for actors, but I still found its existence comforting, its appearance a positive sign. Last week I opened the car door, and one of Peter's golf balls rolled out and onto the street, and I thought, there was a time when this would have been a very big deal. Today my car not only has random golf balls in it, but also khaki-colored sun hats that resemble those worn by beekeepers, an assortment of bandanas, those sunglasses that are only meant to be used as protective eyewear during a racket sport, and dog-eared paperback books of poetry. Now I take these items for granted. Back then, a man's golf ball rolling out of my car would have prompted frenzied calls to my girlfriends. He left a golf ball in the car. He just left it there. What does it mean? What does it mean? Should I text him about it? I should, right? He's probably looking all over for it. I wish I'd enjoyed my single days more and spent my free time reading or becoming a better photographer or something, and not worried so much about the meaning of golf balls. Because here's the thing. I was fine on my own, and so are you. But it can be hard when you feel ready for happy couplehood and you seem to have missed the train. As my friend Oliver Platt used to say to me about hopes and dreams I'd share with him, it's coming, just not on your time frame. I find this a helpful reminder in any number of ways, not only when you're hoping to meet someone, but also when you're waiting for a better job or for some relief during a bleak time. When Peter and I held hands that night all those years ago, I had no idea we'd end up shopping at REI together one day. It might have been nice if he could have turned to me and said, look, tonight isn't the time, but we're going to leave here and learn a bunch of things that are going to make this work approximately 5 years from now. See you then. But life doesn't often spell things out for you or give you what you want exactly when you want it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called life. It would be called vending machine. It's hard to say exactly when it will happen. And it's true that whatever you're after may not drop down the moment you spend all your quarters. But someday soon, a train is coming. In fact, it may already be on the way. You just don't know it yet. See photo 14. Labor Days. I've been fortunate to work for many wonderful writers in television and film. I've done several classic plays and musicals, performed a handful of works by Shakespeare, and, while in graduate school, studied the works of Chekhov and Ibsen in depth. Which is why I feel confident in my ability to assure you that, without a doubt, the most challenging line of dialogue that's ever been conceived by an author to be performed by an actor is, "Welcome to Chili's!" Hamlet, Schmamlet, go ahead right now and try that line at home. In that short phrase, you must convey happiness, wholesomeness, hospitality, cleanliness, family values, and a potato that's been well-baked, all without a trace of cynicism. Undersell it and you risk coming off like a surly teen who was forced to take a job for the summer. Overdo it and you may seem haughty in a way that unintentionally conveys that you think this place is beneath you and that you're still angry about being passed over for the hostess position at the Olive Garden. For years before I was ever cast in a real part, I auditioned for and ended up making many commercials. Some actors I knew at the time thought commercials were a bad pursuit. They felt they weren't artistic enough. Some worried the repetition of days spent holding up a jar of peanut butter and grinning crazily at it would give them bad habits as an actor. For me, I found that the routine of auditioning almost every day made me more able to handle my nerves when something bigger came up. I'd schlep into the city from Brooklyn with my giant book bag, in which I always carried both a blue denim shirt to play moms and other people who cared about detergent, and a black blazer to play young professionals who tended to care more about cars and banks. And even if I didn't get the job, I felt I'd done something that day. I liked the feeling that I was working, even if it wasn't exactly Hedda Gabler. The only line I drew artistically was regarding feminine protection ads. I wasn't sure if I'd ever have any success as an actor, but even if not, I knew I didn't want to be immortalized on film riding a horse on a beach as the sun set, feeling fresh. During this time when I wasn't playing someone whose biggest worry in life was her dishpan hands, I frequently worked as a background player. This involved being paid approximately $100 to pretend to read the label on a tuna fish can in a fake grocery store aisle in the very distant background of a shot of the person who actually had been hired to bemoan her dishpan hands. In every single commercial I ever auditioned for, we were advised by the casting people to speak into the camera like you're talking to your best friend. In life, if I ever spent longer than 10 seconds talking about my dry hands or how delicious a certain line of frozen entrees was, even with one-third fewer calories, or how truly bouncing and behaving my hair was lately, I'd have no friends. At the time, it was a struggle to stay afloat in Manhattan. How times have not changed. Occasionally, I'd have a commercial run on air long enough to pay the bills for a few months. But I made a rule that I'd keep some sort of day job up until the time when acting became enough of a conflict that I had to quit. But as I licked fake toothpaste off my teeth for the millionth time, I wondered if that day would ever come. Over a Labor Day weekend a few years ago, Peter and I were invited to a party at the home of Larry Owen, a professor of his in college. In honor of the holiday, Larry had asked everyone to write down all the jobs they'd ever done to make money. At the party, everyone shared their lists, and it made for some lively conversation. Some of Peter's jobs included snow removal, movie theater usher, and morning janitor at a place called the Chopstick Inn. He worked the fish and chips booth at the State Fair, sold Time Life books over the phone, and worked the night shift as a proofreader for Merrill Lynch. He delivered pizzas, worked as the pantry chef at a Bennigan's, and tended lawns for a landscaper. His least favorite job was insulating houses. He always went home feeling suspiciously itchy. One of his favorites was bartending on Broadway, where he got to see free theater and work alongside an unknown aspiring writer named Aaron Sorkin. I wonder whatever happened to that guy. One summer in Peter's home state, Minnesota, he worked as a puppeteer with a mobile puppet stage. He'd hitch the puppet wagon to his car and drive from park to park, entertaining kids. One day the hitch came loose, and the wagon tipped over, scattering puppets all across County Road C. The police arrived to survey the scene. "The paperwork on this is going to take a while," one of them said. Peter, nervous he was going to be late to his next gig, asked why. The cop nodded at the scattered puppet bodies. "We got a lot of casualties here," he deadpanned. In high school, I mucked out stalls at a barn in my neighborhood and drove a summer camp school bus. Yep, I replaced drives a stick shift with licensed bus driver on my resume under special skills. Still, strangely, no takers. One of my first steady jobs the summer before my freshman year of college was as a receptionist in a hair salon. That summer, it was like I caught some sort of bug from watching people get their hair done all day. When I started that job, my hair was down to the middle of my back, and by the time I was ready to head off to school, I'd practically cut it all off. I've long since destroyed all the photos of me with that haircut, sadly for you. But to give you a sense of the situation, here's the picture I gave the stylist as inspiration for what I wanted. See photo 15. It's Sheena Easton with some real spiky hair. Decades from now, historians will still be debating whether it was the freshman 15 or the razor-sharp sideburns that kept me completely date-free that year. During college, I waitressed, ushered at an off-Broadway theater, and spent Saturday nights on a folding chair in a closet as a coat check girl. I was an aide at a kindergarten where I was obviously in way over my head since, as you may remember, I skipped kindergarten and still had no idea what they did there. And I stacked books in the law library at Columbia, a job I chose specifically to meet guys, but which turned out to be a total bust since, unlike the undergraduate libraries I'd been in, people actually studied there. After college, I worked at Barney's New York, where I'd like to retroactively apologize for whatever you bought from me that I told you was the perfect thing to wear to your corporate law office. To this day, I haven't been in too many of those, and back then, I probably thought the neon pink hoodie and tassel-covered wedges would show not only you were a good lawyer, but most important, that you were still fun. I was also a cocktail waitress at a comedy club called The Improv on 46th Street. The excellent comic Dave Attell worked the door back then, and from the back of the dark room, in between slinging drinks, I watched a young Ray Romano perform stand-up. Now, whenever this comes up in conversation, Ray always asks me the same thing, forgetting that he's asked me already. Did I hit on you? Why no, Ray, you did not, even though my sideburns had totally grown in by then. One summer during grad school, I lived in Chicago. My friend Maria and I got jobs at the famous diner, Ann Sather, where we worked behind the cinnamon roll counter every morning starting at 5 o'clock. We sold only two items, cinnamon rolls and coffee, so the days were usually pretty uneventful. But one day we looked up after the morning rush and noticed that someone had left behind an open purse on the counter with what looked like a big bag of cocaine in it. We peeked inside, searching for anything that might help us find the owner. It may seem weird that we went digging around in someone else's bag after we found drugs in it, but at first we weren't positive that's what it was, since neither of us had ever seen cocaine except in movies. But we finally came to the conclusion that, yep, that's what it was, all right. How thrilling! We'd cracked this case wide open! This must be how Cagney and Lacey felt all the time. Just then, a very pale and sweaty woman came up to the counter. Excuse me, did you find a, she stuttered, eyes shifting around nervously. We nodded and handed her the bag. She stuffed a $50 bill in the tip jar and made a hasty exit. It didn't occur to us until later that giving someone their drugs back rather than calling the police is the literal definition of aiding and abetting. Also, we decided that people who can afford giant bags of cocaine should really be embarrassed at leaving anything less than a cool hundy in the tip jar. From the showcase my acting school class performed in New York after graduation, I finally scored an agent. But for a long time, nothing came of the few auditions I got. So I taught SAT test prep, driving my rusty green Honda Accord out to places like Far Rockaway and Staten Island. I also worked for a catering company, demonstrated the Uno card game at the annual toy fair, and for one very long and clammy day, wore a giant dog costume to play the mascot at a World Cup soccer convention. It took me half a day in the costume to realize there was no need for me to smile while taking photos with the attendees. They couldn't see my face through the giant head I was wearing. And anyway, my grin was already painted across my face in furry black whiskers. Also, in case you were wondering, no, it does not feel good when someone gleefully knocks on the side of your doggy head and asks if it's hot in there. Yes, sir. Yes, it is. Also, while I understand that your friends find it funny, please stop scratching me behind the ears. Finally, after about 3 years of booking only commercials and a few lines on soap operas here and there, I was cast in a supporting part in a play at the George Street Playhouse in New Jersey. My first union job since my role as Blinky McDryeyes in Summerstock. I promptly turned in my apron at the Mexican restaurant I'd been working at in Park Slope, Brooklyn. My boss, Joe, was very nice about it. He told me I was welcome back any time, which was not only cool of him, but also proved he didn't know how many free margaritas I'd been giving away to all my friends. Would I be back? I wondered. Or was the day job portion of my career finally over? I'd love to say that all those hours spent doing things I had to do in order to survive, in order to inch closer to the thing I very much wanted to do, also gave me usable skills that I carried forward with me in life. I'd like to tell you that, thanks to that first real job and its resulting hideous haircut, Steven Spielberg stopped me on the street, demanding to know where I got my pointy sideburns and incredible acting ability. But that did not happen. The takeaway from my many jobs, as far as I can tell, is this. 1. Don't throw away hideous pictures of yourself. You may need to use them in your book one day. 2. Demand more money when returning drugs to strangers. 3. Dog costumes are very hot. 4. Oh, and thanks to that one summer I spent working at Benetton, I am, to this day, the guy to ask if you need your sweater neatly folded. Dozens of jobs, one actual skill. At the Labor Day party, we all bonded over our shared tales of that really awful job I had. Not all the stories were about terrible things that happened at work, but the best ones were. Maybe that's why you seldom see actors on talk shows regaling the hosts with stories of that time I was well compensated at an early job I very much enjoyed. There's more comedy in failure than in success, and it's a much more universal language. At the party, the worst jobs also seemed to be the ones everyone felt most proud to have endured. It's an accomplishment to do something well, but maybe even a bigger one to do something well when you'd really rather not be doing it at all. A few years ago, I was back in my old neighborhood in Brooklyn, and when I turned a corner, there was my former boss, Joe, standing out in front of the Mexican restaurant, as if no time had passed at all. "Hey, I used to work here," I said. "I know," he said, like he'd just seen me bussing tables there yesterday. "This was my last real job before I started working as an actor," I told him. "I know," he said. "I gave away a lot of free margaritas," I blurted out. He rolled his eyes. "I know," he said, but he was smiling. I looked inside the restaurant and saw that almost nothing had changed, which was oddly comforting. It made it even easier to picture myself there as I was in 1995, when I was scrappily patched together by green Dep gel, scrunchies, and stirrup pants. I realized that even though that restaurant hadn't been my dream job, I'd really liked working there. The rule I'd made for myself about keeping a day job until I could make a living acting was a good one. Wearing a dog costume was no fun, but I did it because it was more money than I usually made in a day, and I wasn't too proud to hustle. Maybe that's why Professor Owen asked us to make those lists in the first place, to remember where we all started and share stories of how far we'd come, to journey back to whatever each of our individual Brooklyns had been, and look in the window of the Mexican restaurant and remember ourselves as we were, young and hungry. So, welcome to Chili's, y'all. Whether you're saying it for real or just trying to get the part, say it loud and say it proud. Judge not, lest ye be a judge on Project Runway. My life in fashion. As you probably know, I am regularly featured on best dressed lists, constantly praised for owning it and killing it on the red carpet, and have Zac Posen on speed dial. Wait, that's not me, that's Cate Blanchett! But obviously, in general, I'm a popular fixture on the fashion scene and can usually be spotted sporting free outfits sent to me by designers while sitting next to Anna Wintour in the front row of all the hottest runway shows during New York Fashion Week before partying the night away with 1 to 7 members of the Kardashian family. Wait, that's not me, that's Gigi Hadid! Wait, that's not her either, because she's a successful top model who is most likely to be walking in the show. Well, whoever's next to Anna in the front row is probably pretty psyched to be sitting in this place of honor. They're also probably hungry, and their shoes are too tight. And whoever they aren't me. But for some reason, I always forget that I'm not really a fashion-type person, and every once in a while, I attempt to be one anyway. Who am I when it comes to fashion? I'm not entirely sure. My dad is 6'3", thin and athletic, so even without him trying very hard, clothes look great on him. He was voted best dressed in high school, even though he went to a Catholic school where they all wore uniforms. So I'm not exactly sure how it was that he distinguished himself or why the school even bothered to assign that superlative to one of hundreds of boys wearing identical navy blue blazers. But what that says to me is that my father was so innately fashionable, he somehow managed to look better dressed than his classmates, even though they were all wearing the exact same thing. So I suppose my dad was my first fashion idol, which is troubling only in that when I was a preteen girl, I learned everything I first knew about what to wear from a tall, preppy lawyer in his 30s. This was the 1980s in Washington, D.C., which meant my key pieces included wide whale corduroys, L.L. Bean boat shoes, and anywhere from 1 to 47 shirts layered on top of one another with collars of varied jauntiness. My turtleneck was up and scrunchy, or sometimes neatly folded down. My Izod collar was down sometimes, unless of course it was up. This made for lots of fun choices, which in any combination ensured you were both overheated and bulky. You really couldn't go wrong. After a while, rather than simply being influenced by my father's law office fashions and continuing to reinterpret them as a teen girl, I began to just cut out the middleman and wear his clothes. Back then, I really didn't like dresses. I remember having to buy a skirt for the 8th grade band recital because I didn't own a single one. Fine, I was a tomboy. But here I am, in one of my dad's starched white dress shirts, which he wore underneath his suits for work. So presumably all the extra length and bulk of a man's dress shirt is tucked into my, probably boy's, Levi's corduroys, thereby obscuring any girl's shape struggling to emerge from beneath. See photo 16. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, The Gap, where I got most of my dad-like clothes, was not yet the fashion-forward, ubiquitous mall shop it has become, but more of a place where construction workers got their basics. Back then, they didn't even carry any of their own name-brand stuff. The Gap specialized in plaid flannel shirts by nameless designers and crunchy Levi's that had to be washed 20 to 30 times before they would stop standing up on their own, Luke Danes-type fashions. Skinny jeans didn't yet exist, but we knew enough to see that straight-leg jeans weren't as flattering as they could be. So some girls I went to school with had their jeans taken in along the inseam. I was too free-spirited, disorganized, for such tailoring frippery. So instead of sewing mine to make the leg narrower, I folded the jeans inward along the inseam and I stapled the two parts together. My look was stocky teenage boy meets Office Depot. But I always liked the idea of fashion and of being fashionable, and as I got older, I felt it was my responsibility to at least try, perhaps in part because of the trend toward actors being not just actors, but also brands of some sort. It's not enough today just to be a good actor, it seems. One must also be a fashion icon, colon cleanse spokesperson, and designer of a line of plus-size dog costumes on the side. Your Saint Bernard has been overlooked for too long. In my family, there are several well-dressed ladies. My mother could take something odd from any sale rack and turn it into part of an elegant ensemble. My stepmother, Karen, and sister, Maggie, both have a great eye for patterns and fun accessories. My sister, Shade, always looks chic in her New York City color palette, which ranges from black to black. And my brother, Chris, like my dad, has a classic East Coast style. It's in my blood, or so I've tried to convince myself again and again. Those first 20 or so years of dad shirts and Stan Smith sneakers were my dormant phase, but I knew that trendsetter Lauren was in there somewhere, just waiting to come out. So when the call came one early summer day to be a judge on one of my favorite shows, Project Runway, I thought my fashion destiny had finally found me. Peter and I were spending the weekend in East Hampton, so not only was the call exciting in itself, but the whole request took on a beachy Nancy Meyers movie golden glow. Oh, oh, look at me. I walk barefoot on the beach, wearing a straw hat I paid $9 million for at Calypso on Main Street. I got this iced coffee at Once Upon a Bagel in Sagaponack. I vacation in the Hamptons. I'm a judge on Project Runway. Whose life is this? Bethany Frankel's? After all those years of schlepping around Manhattan in my black puffy Reebok high tops, I am now positively killing it as a New Yorker. The episode I'd been asked to do was the season 10 premiere. I learned that Pat Field, the incredible stylist from Sex and the City, would also be a guest judge, along with the regular judges Michael Kors and Nina Garcia, and of course, host and supermodel Heidi Klum. Just picturing the company I'd be keeping already made me feel better dressed. I got to borrow a Michael Kors dress for the shoot, and I had fancy people doing my hair and makeup. This was unusual for me then, but I dreamed that in my new, more fashionable life, I'd be calling a day like that Tuesday. Because it was to be the first episode of the season and an anniversary to boot, they set up a special runway in the middle of Times Square so that fans could be in the audience for a portion of the show. I was driven over to the location in a limo with Heidi, who was extremely friendly and welcoming. She waved from the open window and smiled for photos in the middle of Times Square. People were giddy to see her. Backstage, I met Tim Gunn, who was kind and gracious. What a lovely way to start our season, he said upon meeting me. I blushed from head to toe. The judges were then seated in a row of chairs near the runway and handed index cards on which to write our comments. Heidi and Tim welcomed the audience and announced the start of the season. The crowd cheered. Loud music thumped through the outdoor speakers. The show began. I guess what I remember most about the runway show was nothing. I remember nothing. Oh, God, what just happened? The show was over in what seemed like a blink. Prior to this night, my concept of a show involved popcorn or intermission or perhaps complaints about the unnecessary length of that one scene in Act Two. This show was over before I even had time to become uncomfortable on my folding chair. Also, and this will come as a shock to absolutely no one, models make everything look great. I'd just watched a series of the most beautiful young women in the world walk by. Who cared what they were wearing? Oh, supposedly, me. The other judges stood up and started musing about the show while, in a state of utter panic, I racked my brain for details, trying to come up with anything at all I could remember from the blur I just experienced. Okay, think. That one model was wearing pants, I guess? Or were those actually pants? Or was it a skirt of some... No, pants, I think? These were my detailed fashion impressions. Then someone came to collect our index cards from us. I looked down at the cards in my hand and, heart pounding, realized I'd written almost nothing on them. Wait, are we... These are our scores? We're turning in the scores now? I said to Nina, dumbstruck. Yes, she said, totally friendly. What did you think of the show? I grinned idiotically in a way I hoped looked haute couture, mumbled something like, oh, wow, it's with the clothes making, and turned back to my blank cards. Hastily, I wrote down as much as I could remember from what I'd just seen and assigned some scores randomly. Even now, I couldn't tell you what the scoring system is or even the range of numbers it involves. It's like I had a fashion-induced blackout. Was it 1 to 10 or 0 to 100? The giant X's they use on America's Got Talent? I have literally no idea. Once back in the studio, I calmed down a little. It was exciting to be on a set I found so familiar after having watched every episode. The judges have all worked together for years, so there was lots of laughter and chit-chat as we waited to begin. Then, one by one, the contestants filed out to stand on the stage beside the models wearing their garments. The first thing I noticed was how close we were to the contestants, almost uncomfortably close, much closer than it looks on television, yet still too far away to make small talk. Whatever the distance is that makes those two things simultaneously possible is one I'd never experienced before. The effect of this strange, faraway intimacy meant that everyone just sort of stared at each other without saying much in between critiques. Plus, in order to get those swoopy camera angles, they put the camera on a swoopy mechanical arm thing, and we were warned that the swooping takes a while. So between critiques, the camera flew around on its arm like some sort of drunk helicopter, getting reaction shots from each contestant and then from the judges. They asked us to hold our reactions as best we could until they got to us. Ever smile for a photograph for someone who doesn't know how to work their camera? 20 times longer than that. My mouth started to tremble from trying to hold a smile. During one of these awkward frozen moments, one of the contestants grinned at me and mouthed the words, I love you. And I tried as best I could to communicate my thanks while also maintaining my frozen mannequin face. Unfortunately, when it came time for the judges to give their critiques, this same girl turned out to be in the bottom three. This part is also a bit of a blur, but from my many years as a viewer, I'll guess Nina said something about a garment being reminiscent of Dior in the 70s. Michael said a textile looked like a frat house bath mat, and Heidi found one of the dresses too sad. When it came to me, I tried my best to come up with an opinion that was also not an opinion. I think I said something like, maybe the t-shirt is a little too t-shirty, or something equally benign. But the girl who'd mouthed that she loved me looked as if I'd punched her, and that's when I realized the real problem I'd been having all evening was simply that I didn't like being a judge. I'd never judged anything in my life before, and even if I'd discovered I was an okay judge in general, even if I liked telling other people my opinions, the truth was that I wasn't really very qualified in this particular arena. If anyone at the show had seen how many pairs of sweatpants I had at home, they'd have shown me the door. My favorite outfits are jumpsuits. I buy too many. They always just seem like such a good idea at the time. I'm probably drawn to them because they remind me of my favorite childhood pajamas, but without the built-in slippers. There's one jumpsuit I wear that Peter calls my "that nice lady who works at the gas station" look. In fashion, I've always been more of a follower than a leader. Here, I'm copying not only my cousin Heather's wardrobe, but also her bedhead chic hairstyle and rockin' smize. That's what a smize is, right? See photo 17. I actually really love when I get to prepare for a big, over-the-top event that is seriously glamorous. I view the work of fashion designers like I do any art, and I get a kick out of occasionally dressing up in a big way. But being exposed to the world of a big night out doesn't necessarily translate into real life. It's like learning how to make a souffle, then being asked to put dinner on the table for five teenage boys on a Monday night. I know you just got home from basketball practice, but would you guys mind waiting 45 minutes to an hour for an airy and eggy dessert that isn't even filling? As a viewer of Project Runway, my favorite part has always been watching people create things, then following the decisions they made to see how they got to a finished product. In so many ways, that's the work of an actor, too, and something I totally relate to. The judging was the least fun part. As a friend, I don't mind giving advice when I'm asked, but if you don't take it, I'm not going to ask you to clean up your workspace and go home. I felt embarrassed, too. I can't even stand giving feedback to the potato peeler I bought on Amazon. What made me think this would be any different? For weeks after the show was over, I went on and on to all my friends about my runway show semi-blackout, how worried I still was about the nice girl and my t-shirty comment, and how in general my reaction to being a judge was much different from what I'd expected. I told them all about who got cut and why, what really went on behind the scenes, and what we had for dinner. Everyone wants to know what models eat. One day, I was telling my lawyer, Adam, my stories, and he stopped me mid-sentence. Wait. It's just me you're telling all this to, right? I mean, you haven't been telling other people any of these stories, have you? When I told him that yes, in fact, I had, because I was really, really traumatized by judging, he stopped me again. Lauren, he said, with genuine concern in his voice, you aren't allowed to talk about any of that. You signed a confidentiality agreement. Well, right, I tried to joke, but I didn't actually read it that carefully. What do you think I have a lawyer for? He responded by telling me that everything I'd been saying was in total breach of my contract. Great. I was such a bad judge that now I might have to sit in front of a real one. I pictured Tim Gunn, sad about having to testify against me. Well, I thought it was a lovely way to start our season, but now... Over the years, I've gotten to do some pretty exciting things. Peter and I once made an appearance at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, where we got escorted through the crowds and massive balloons to have an up-close experience I'll never forget. I was flown to Amsterdam for a week to promote Gilmore Girls. I hosted the American Cinema Editors Award, the Eddies, where I got to fulfill my lifelong dream of delivering this piece of genius comedy. Hey, who cut one? I once rode the Disney jet when I was doing a series for ABC. I got to bring my friend Jen, and there was a marching band waiting for us on the tarmac when we arrived. Not the usual way you expect to be greeted at work. I've also been asked to do a lot of really unexpected things. One time I was invited to speak at a toilet paper convention. Another, to go on a morning show and discuss calcium supplements. Over the course of my career, I've gotten requests as odd and varied as promoting a line of cat food. I don't have a cat. Being on the cover of a golf magazine. I don't play golf. And appearing on Sesame Street. I did this one. I know he's really famous, but guys, Grover is so down to earth in real life. I've learned that it's always nice to be invited to a party. There's just no way to know ahead of time what the party will be like. In fashion, one day you're in, and the next day you're out. I was literally in for just the one day, but I realized I'm happier being out, or better yet, at home on my couch, wearing sweatpants, watching as a fan. Oh, and in case you were wondering, we ordered from a nice Japanese restaurant in Midtown, and Heidi had tofu in black bean sauce. Please remember how much you enjoyed that information, because I'm speaking to you from jail. This prison jumpsuit I'm wearing isn't as flattering as some of the ones I have at home, but that's okay. I'll just have to make it work. Someday, someday, maybe, you'll believe my novel wasn't completely autobiographical. I was in Atlanta, and it was the night before we were about to start filming the movie Middle School, based on the books by James Patterson and Chris Tebbets. At the cast dinner, I was thrillingly and frighteningly seated next to James Patterson himself, the author of countless thrillers, epic franchises that became Hollywood blockbusters, and a surprising number of children's books. So I couldn't help but ask him the question he's probably been asked a million times. How do you do it? He turned to me and said, keep going, keep going, keep going. Whoa. That pretty much says it all, I guess. One day in 2011, I was sitting in my trailer after finishing a day of work on Parenthood. I'd filmed a few scenes that morning, but we'd gotten through them fairly quickly. I'd already worked out that day, spoken to my dad, answered some emails, and had lunch. It was too early to start making dinner, and I didn't quite feel like going home yet. I realized that for the first time in what felt like years, I had something I almost never had. extra time on my hands. When I was in high school and college, there were always a million homework assignments due, projects I needed to work on, plays and musicals to rehearse. After school, out in the real world, there was also always something hanging over my head, making enough money to pay the rent, pounding the pavement all over New York, and later, driving all over Los Angeles, trying to get people to hire me, trying to land somewhere even a little bit permanent, so that I didn't wake up every morning with a pit in my stomach, wondering where my next paycheck was coming from. When I finally did land somewhere on Gilmore Girls, there was hardly time to notice. The years I spent there were packed full, dialogue to memorize, long hours of filming, and all that went into publicizing the show. During the summers between seasons of the show, I hadn't wanted to rest either. I did movies and plays whenever I could, anxious to keep the momentum up. Keep going, keep going, keep going. So that day, in my parenthood trailer, the realization that I had free time was an odd feeling, and an unfamiliar one. And there was something else, too. For a moment, I couldn't pin it down. It was almost as if someone else was in the room. Finally, it came to me. It was a voice, I guess? When it finally spoke, it asked me something unexpected. "Did you, make it?" the voice whispered, surprised. As a working actor, you're always being asked when it was that you finally knew you'd made it. Most actors I know, myself included, respond with something resembling, "Never." Acting is such a precarious profession that most of us wisely never relax, never stop watching our backs, never feel we have true job security. Even if the evidence is to the contrary, most of us feel we aren't yet safe. If necessary, I could pick up a tray tomorrow and take your order. I remember those years like no time has passed. I never take this career for granted. There are far more actors who worked for a while and disappeared than there are actors who stuck around for decades. So when I tell you that a whispery voice in my ear asked me if I'd made it, I don't at all mean in the red carpet interviewer sense. I don't mean it as in, I saw my face on the side of a bus, or I won an award, or I just bought my fourth Ferrari, and it was then I knew I'd made it. I mean it in a subtler sense. The voice suggested that maybe the time had come to accept that I didn't have to wake up every day with ulcer-inducing terror over where my next meal was coming from. Again, this was in 2011. I'd been supporting myself steadily as an actor since 1996, and the idea that maybe this was going to work out after all was occurring to me for the very first time. Actors, how therapists stay in business. I mean, what was I thinking back then when I decided to go into acting? Really, who did I think I was? Show business? Who does that? Starting out, I hadn't known anyone with even the vaguest connection to this mysterious world. In high school, I had the lead in the musical my junior year, you remember Hello Dolly, but didn't get the lead my senior year, and I remember thinking, I've peaked. It's all over. So I wondered what had kept me going after that. Through thousands of rejections and with no way of knowing, I'd be sitting in a trailer on the Universal lot one day 20 years later with my bills relatively paid and time on my hands. I pictured the brownstone in Brooklyn I'd lived in after grad school with Kathy, my best friend from college. I remembered some of the jobs I'd taken to make ends meet, catering and waitressing and working as a tutor, answering phones as a temp, and trying to sell CPR lessons over the phone. I kept all my appointments in a Filofax day planner. Pagers were considered novel technology, and Times Square was still full of X-rated movies. Things had changed so much since then. I had changed so much. Far from being asked about making it, I'd found that the question that came up most often back then was some version of, "When will you be giving this ridiculous pipe dream up?" Back then, I'd asked myself this with alarming frequency as well. When you have no credits on your resume, there's no proof yet, one way or the other. There's no way to know if the time you're spending will someday prove to be time you spent paying your dues or time you spent fooling yourself. While I didn't want to write about myself exactly, I wondered if maybe a story of dreaming big, growing up, and forging a career was sort of universal. I hadn't given myself a time limit as an actor, but others I know did, and it occurred to me that might create a ticking clock that would help structure the story. I opened a Word document and started a... what? I didn't even know what it was yet. It turned out to be a novel. Someday, Someday Maybe is about a young girl named Franny Banks who comes to New York City to follow her dream of becoming an actress. Aided by the pages of her Filofax datebook, we follow a year in her life, sort of like a year in the life, at the end of which she's vowed to give up and move back home if she doesn't find success. Set in the 1990s, it takes place in a New York City that has changed a great deal since then. The first thing I wrote was an anxiety dream that Franny has the night before an audition. It ended up also being one of the first things I cut. But over the next few weeks, I just kept going, kept going, kept going. It was a thrilling novelty to have something I could work on just by myself. I didn't need a set or a script or another actor. I loved my main character, Franny, of course, but it was just as fun to create the others. My friend Kathy was sort of the inspiration for Jane, but then Jane started taking on a life of her own. James Franklin, a bad boy type whom Franny falls for, wasn't based on anyone in particular. He was inspired by some of the very actory actors I've known and have always been intrigued by, the ones who seem like they're never not playing the character of extremely deep artiste. Barney Sparks, Franny's first agent, was nothing like any agent I ever had. I just liked the idea of her starting out with someone who'd been in the business a long time and who spoke in clichés that were also sincerely heartfelt. So while my original inspiration was personal, it wasn't really about me. Even if I'd wanted to use more details from my life at the time, I didn't keep a diary, and my memory isn't that good. And when I started working on it, I had no particular goal in mind. It wasn't a calculated play to cash in on some backstory of mine. I was just enjoying trying something new that was creative, something that allowed me to connect with another time and place. In fact, I went out of my way to make the characters not resemble anyone from my real life. I would never want the real people I work with to feel parodied or exploited. It's one of the things that slowed me down considerably on my second novel. More on that in a moment. I'd think, oh, a fun character would be an outspoken publicist who's always sending Franny to D-list events in order to get seen. But then I don't want anyone to assume I'm parodying the publicist I'm working with, who's a man, so maybe I'll change the publicist to a woman. But I don't want anyone to think I'm making fun of that one female publicist. You see the problem. The first 100 pages just spilled out. They were a pleasure and a breeze, and to date, that's the last time writing anything has ever come so easily. One day I mentioned to my agent that I'd been working on something just for fun, and he asked me to send it to him, which I did with apologies. It was very rough, I told him. I hadn't even proofread it for typos, I told him. But he read my scrappy pages and, without telling me, forwarded them to one of the best and best-known book agents at ICM and in the galaxy, Esther Newberg. I'd only met Esther once, years before. Since then, I've come to know her as an excellent dinner date and raconteur. Esther is smart, stylish, and a devoted Red Sox fan. But what I knew about her then was mostly that she hailed from the no-bullshit school of agenting. This should be an actual school. Someone call Shark Tank. Many agents have attended its sister campus, the Amazing Amazing School, a related but very different institution where even the three lines you had on that Friday night sitcom were so impressive they should earn you an Emmy. These agents are pleasant to deal with, but their comments require some translation on your part. Over time, you learn that you're amazing means you're just okay. The ratings are great means your show's getting canceled. And you look fantastic means you've gained weight. I'll write it all up for you in another helpful chart. No bullshit is by far my favorite school. My conversation with Esther went something like this.
I read your pages.
Oh, wow. Really? They're not even...
I can get to a lot of money if I sell this book to certain people.
Are you kidding? That's great. I mean, I wasn't even doing it for the...
But I don't want to sell it to those people.
Oh. No? Okay.
Because you know what else these people would buy from you?
No, I don't.
Monkey doodles.
Monkey.
Yes. From you, they'd buy a book of monkey crayon doodles. They'd buy a cookbook covering just nuts. They'd buy the confessions of your split end. And you know why?
No.
The Today Show. Hi, Tamron.
The Today Show? Hi, Willie.
The Today Show. Hi, Carson. Filling in again, Jenna? You can get booked as a guest on the Today Show. Hi, Al. You can get a spot on Ellen. Books are hard to sell, and you have these ways to promote a book, and that's the main reason these certain people would buy your book. I don't want to sell this book to those people.
Oh, okay. Makes sense, I guess. Well, thanks anyway. I really appreciate...
But there are other people.
Other...
Well, there are three. Three other people.
In all of publishing?
Three people. Editors, I mean, whom I would trust with this. Three people who would only take it on because they believe in you and the book. But if one of them doesn't take it, I think we should wait. Unless you want me to call the monkey doodle people.
No, I wasn't even, I was just sitting in my trailer one day and...
Well then, we'll see what the people say.
Okay, let me just clean up the pages first and...
I already sent the pages to the people.
You already...
I'll let you know.
Suddenly, my solo trailer project had become a new way in which I'd potentially set myself up for more rejection. Suddenly, I was waiting to see if I'd be accepted into another competitive world where people I'd never met would have opinions about my work. Why didn't I pick up knitting? Why didn't I take a sailing class instead? Pottery? Why was I torturing myself? I felt nervous and neurotic. Would I be accepted? Maybe we should call the Monkey Doodle people? After all, an entire cookbook of nut recipes wasn't a terrible idea. And maybe my split ends would be healed if only they had the chance to speak out. Writers, How Therapists by Summer Holmes. I don't remember if all three editors were interested. Two were. I think three. Let's say they all were. Who can stop me? It's my book. I'm drunk with power. But the proposal letter sent by my current editor, Jennifer E. Smith, jumped out at me and made her the clear choice. Jen is a talented YA author. She's from Chicago. She talks very fast. When Jen and I first met in person, I told her the story of writing my senior thesis as an English major in college. I confess that I turned it in late after writing it directly in a word processor and correcting my typos and mistakes with whiteout. I just barely scraped by deadline-wise. Jen, who was also an English major, laughed but looked slightly spooked by this information. She admitted to me that she was so well organized in college that she finished her senior thesis 2 weeks early, but she lied about it and pretended to still be working up to the deadline because she didn't want her friends to feel bad or think she was too much of a geek. She may have been concerned about my deadline issues, but I thought this made us the perfect match. Ever see a buddy movie where one guy is the ne'er-do-well loose cannon and the other guy is too? No? Exactly. What's the fun of the ne'er-do-well loose cannon without the buttoned-up friend slash brother slash other cop who's trying to ensure he stays within the law? I was the Eddie Murphy to her Nick Nolte, the Bruce Willis to her Sam Jackson, the Hooch to her Turner. Sorry, it seems I stopped going to the movies in 1989. The good news was that I'd been paired with an ideal partner. The bad news was that the minute I sold the book and it became an assignment with a deadline and people counting on me, I sort of froze up. This resulted in writing sessions where I stared at the blank computer screen with my heart thumping and a metallic taste in my mouth, my new definition of the boots of time marching all over me. To cope, I went down Google rabbit holes involving outdoor patio furniture and artisanal Korean pepper sauces. I'd write three lines, erase four, and look up which fish sauce to use when making Nook Cham. Red Boat 40N, 50N if you can find it. Nook Cham is a Vietnamese dipping sauce that calls for sambal oelek, an Indonesian chili paste, but I also sometimes use the Korean chili paste gochujang, and I find if you chop the ginger very fine, you can... Now do you see where my book took so long? Also, the best time to buy patio furniture on sale is at the end of the summer or early fall. Spring is when they get you. Jen has become a friend as well as an invaluable person in my work life. Sometimes she tells me I need to throw something out. Sometimes she tells me I need to dig deeper. But early on, the main challenge was simply getting me to fill up more pages. Just give me something, she'd say. Don't worry too much. If you hit a rough patch, skip over it. You can go back and make it perfect later, but first you need a draft. I can't edit a blank page. Eventually, I learned that, in the beginning at least, it was better for me to be finished than to try to be perfect. I had to get out of my own way. It wasn't that the voice in my head, the one telling me my pages weren't good enough, went away, exactly. I just didn't let it stop me. An important tool against self-doubt is just to ignore it. Forge ahead, anyway. Just keep going, keep going, keep going. I gave myself the goal of writing 1,000 words a day. Sometimes I hit it, sometimes not. I had no routine. I wrote at work between scenes, at the kitchen table, on airplanes. My process was nonlinear and often chaotic. If I hit a scene or a plot point that stumped me, I'd put the missing scene in bold so I would remember to come back to it later. Dan, wedding scene to come. Sometimes I didn't even know what the missing scene might be. Franny says, blah, blah, something here. Talk about medical, medical. I was filling every free minute, working harder than I had in years. So it was surprising that when I told people I was writing a novel, the two questions I got most often were, is anyone helping you? And, are you doing that all by yourself? You know, the same questions male authors get asked. I guess there is a tradition of memoirs sometimes being ghostwritten. Chuck, make sure this part really seems like I wrote it, and remind me to delete this note. But fiction? There seemed to be some bias I couldn't quite put my finger on. The book was far from perfect, but eventually it was done. Letting go of it was the strangest thing. I'd feel happy with a passage 1 week, but a week later I'd find things about it I wanted to change. I realized that the practice of writing the book had actually slowly and over time made me a better writer, so I'd see parts that I'd done months back and realize I could now do better, which meant I wanted to keep revising. But when does the revising end? I'd committed to a publishing date for one thing, but even if I hadn't, at some point you have to let it go, or it isn't a book for sale, it's a pile of papers on your desk. The actor equivalent of this would be to film a scene, then watch it and think, why'd I do that with my hands? That shirt isn't flattering. I'm not as connected as I could be. Let's go back and do it again. You could keep improving that one scene over and over, but the movie would never get made. I'm going to pull this out of your hands now, Jen finally said. Promoting the book was a new experience, too. I did some signings at bookstores and got to be interviewed